present The Hollow Man, a Dr. Fell mystery by John Dixon Carr. Dramatized for radio by Peter Ling. With Donald Sinden as Dr. Fell. Part 1, Into Thin Air.
Take a deep breath, Mr. Mills. There's no need to be alarmed. Inspector Hadley is just trying to get the facts absolutely clear.
All right, Doctor. Leave it to me. Mr. Mills, are you telling me this mysterious stranger just disappeared off the face of the earth?
I'm telling you what happened, Inspector. Three of us saw him. The other two actually spoke to him. And a few minutes later, this weird-looking man vanished.
Ah.
And he's never been seen since.
So he was weird-looking, was he?
Yes, he was. You see, he was wearing a mask. A shiny pink mask. The kind children wear at parties. And a black cap pulled well down. And a long black coat with a collar turned up. He pushed his way into the study. And after that, he just disappeared into thin air.
Is that all you can tell us? You must have some ideas about the man, some theory.
There's only one idea that keeps occurring to me. Though I'm trying to put it out of my mind. But I can't help wondering if perhaps the murderer was like the invisible man in H.G. Wells' story. And that if you took away the black cap and the black coat and the false face, inside, you might find nothing at all.
There are not many detective story writers who, having created one classic detective, become themselves the inspiration for another. But this is what happened to G.K. Chesterton, who, having created Father Brown, then inspired John Dixon Carr's Dr. Gideon Fell. Carr was an American, born in Pennsylvania in 1906, but he settled in England in 1933 after his marriage to an Englishwoman, and there began publishing the exploits of the archetypal English eccentric, Dr. Gideon Fell. The series eventually ran to 23 novels and a clutch of short stories. What were Carr's qualities as a detective story writer? His biographer, Professor Douglas Green.
John Dixon Carr was probably the most ingenious of all detective story writers. And one of the great part of his ingenuity is he never tells the same story twice. He had a specific theory about it, which was that it must be fair to the reader. You must give the reader all the clues, and Carr was probably, along with Christie and Ellery Queen, maybe one or two others, the most punctilious in giving all the clues to the reader. But he had attitudes within the detective story which were not part of the Agatha Christie school. He tended to want the detective story to fit into the story of romance, of adventure, even of gothicism, unlike the Christie and Sayers and Allingham and others who saw it as part of a drawing room comedy. And Carr didn't look at it that way. He looked upon the detective story as being involved with one's, you know, primal emotions, the fears of the unknown, the fears that the pit is about to open and that you'll be overwhelmed with it. And that gives his stories a peculiar flavor that's quite different from anything else done at the time.
Is that... is it?
I'm afraid it is. Blood.
Oh.
No doubt about that.
Oh.
Now, easy, baby. Take it easy.
But what's happened to the girl? Where is she now? And why did someone make up the bunk with clean sheets and blankets?
I don't know why, but... come on, Doctor. Let's lift the mattress.
Oh, my.
Good God.
What is it?
A razor. An old-fashioned cutthroat razor.
Beautifully made. The handle's ebony with a design in chased silver. The head and shoulders of a man with a razor in his fist. A barber.
There's something round his eyes. A bandage.
A blind barber. Oh, that's horrible.
Yes. The blind barber has been at work tonight.
England and the English atmosphere were very important to Carr.
He looked upon England as representing what was old, what was stable, where you could still have adventure as against the modern world. In his very first Dr. Fell book, Hag's Nook, He begins with a chapter of just Anglophilic warmth.
There is something spectral about the deep and drowsy beauty of the English countryside, and the lush dark grass, the evergreens, the gray church spire, and the meandering white road. To an American who remembers his own brisk concrete highways clogged with red filling stations and the fumes of traffic, it is particularly pleasant. It suggests a place where people really can walk, without seeming incongruous, even in the middle of the road. Tad Rampole watched the sun through the latticed windows and the dull red berries glistening in the yew tree with a feeling which can haunt the traveler only in the British Isles, a feeling that the earth is old and enchanted, a sense of reality in all the flashing images which are conjured up by that one word, Mary. The bells at twilight seem to be bells across the centuries. There is a great stillness through which ghosts step, and Robin Hood has not strayed from it even yet. Carr detested the characteristically American hard-boiled school of detective writing, declaring, "My real objection to the hard-boiled school is that it isn't toughness at all, it's merely bad manners, and bad manners I dislike more than anything on this earth." He was far more interested in the how rather than the why of crime.
To him, motivation, even though he'd have a variety of motives and would work on it, that was never the particularly interesting point. I think some of this ties into Carr's own background. His family was quite persuaded that he just did not want to know what motivated people. He was not interested in that. In his own upbringing, he learned to hide his own feelings, his own emotions. He and his mother never got along, and he would retreat into these romantic views of the past, the romantic views of a place like England, which may have never had a great deal of reality, but that wasn't the point to him. And he loved looking at how things could be made to fool you.
How was it done? And how did you work it out?
Well, I've been puzzled by the weight of that picture, Burnaby's painting of the graves. It's big, but a framed canvas isn't that heavy. Yet when it was brought into the house, wrapped up in sacking, it took two men to carry it. So it wasn't hard to work out that there must have been something else wrapped up with it. But what would be the same size and shape as a picture, only a damn sight heavier?
Tell me.
A mirror.
Ah.
Grimaud had a very large mirror, taller and wider than the door, propped up just inside the study.
You mean it was one of those damn theatrical illusions?
A new version of an old illusion. When he came upstairs and argued with Madame Dumont for the benefit of their one-man audience, Stuart Mills, he only had to open the door, remove the mask, and Mills would see Professor Grimaud inside coming towards him, dimly, because there was only one small light on the landing. It only took a moment before he stepped inside, and the show was over. But it had served its purpose.
But what became of the mirror? There's no hiding place in this room.
There is. Inside the fireplace. If you look up there, you'll find a ledge just above your head, wide enough and tall enough to take the mirror before it narrows into the chimney. No doubt the effort of lifting the mirror into its hiding place brought on his final hemorrhage.
Yes, but what about the clothes the masked man was wearing? The long black coat and cap and the mask itself?
Do you remember O'Rourke's tale of the vanishing horseman? Grimaud's cap and coat, like the mask, were made of paper. Madame Dumont was a costumier in her younger days. That's why your tests showed nothing except plain paper. Apart from the firework, of course.
What firework?
Grimaud slipped into Drayman's room and took one of the fireworks the old man collected. He didn't have the gun now, but Mills had to hear the sound of a shot. Any more questions?
Unlike the other detective story writers in this series, Carr personally became deeply involved in radio, both in Britain and America.
Well, Carr loved radio anyway. He listened to radio drama a great deal when Val Gilgood was dominating British radio drama in the 30s up till almost our own time. And he met Gilgood at the Savage Club, to which they were both members in London, and Carr suggested he might like to try his hand at a radio drama. And he wrote a play which was in three parts called Who Killed Matthew Corbin, featuring Dr. Fell. And He then did a few historicals for the BBC. And then in 1942, he was called back to America to sign up for the draft. And while waiting for the United States government to assign him to something, he signed up with CBS Broadcasting Network in America and wrote a number of classic plays, people still remember them, for the Suspense radio show, which may well have been the greatest dramatic radio show in American history. It lasted over 20 years. Carr liked American radio somewhat better than the British radio because it was full of the histrionic devices he liked, things they called knife chords. That is, at the key moment when all the tension is up, an organist would hit a chord, which would then give a sort of shock that would go off out over the radio waves. He had invented the man in black for Suspense, and would, in a very creepy voice, introduce the play. Well, finally, the American government decided what to do with him. They sent him back to England to work for the BBC, who had been trying to get him back, suggesting he could work on propaganda scripts. And he did a great number of propaganda scripts, very successfully. But he then suggested to Val Gilgood that because Suspense was so popular in America, the British might like to try the knife chords, the histrionics, all the effects that the American audience liked. And he suggested that some of his Suspense scripts could be used in England, and they then appeared under a series called Appointment with Fear, with Valentine Dial, one of the great radio actors, becoming the man in black.
This is your storyteller, the man in black. Here again to bring you another placid evening in our Farside series, Appointment with Fear. Loss of memory, the eerie darkness which closes down on the brain, is a subject which has often amused me, and that is why I have brought a guest tonight, Dr. Gideon Fell, the celebrated schoolmaster turned detective, to tell you about the Barton case. There sits Dr. Fell himself, all 20 stone of him, with his four chins, his bandit's moustache, his eyeglasses on the broad black ribbon, his face fiery with controversy. And when he tells you about the Barton case, as he told it to me, we trust we shall keep our promise to bring you an appointment with fear. The clock strikes 8.
It was a huge hit. Eventually, some movies were made, some plays were made, called Appointment with Fear, some of which Carr was involved in. And in many ways, it didn't remake British radio. The older style certainly maintained itself, the more restrained dramatic style, but it added this new dimension so that you could, on British radio, bring in all of these techniques to get the audience's emotion. And he became quite the king of that sort of thing.
One of the few Appointment with Fear episodes to have survived in the archive is the Gideon Fell mystery, The Clock Strikes 8, with Richard George as Gideon Fell.
The Barton case, sir? Was a grim business. I saw the last night of it. I saw what the human soul can endure without quite going mad, and I have no wish to see its like again. For I ask you to imagine yourself in the position of that girl, Helen Barton. Suppose, just suppose, that you wake up suddenly in the middle of the night. You wake up as though from a nightmare, with a feeling you've been asleep a very long time. The room is cold and nearly dark, with the faint glimmer of a fire almost out. Slowly, very slowly, you begin to realize it's a room you've never seen before. That fact, above all, strikes at you through a mist of fear. There's a queer atmosphere, like old stone and disinfectant, and no sound at all in that dim room, except...
What is it? What was that noise?
Now,
Now, lean back in your bed, my dear. It's all right.
That's good advice, Miss Barton. You take it easy.
I think I must have been dreaming.
You were having a nightmare, but it's all right now. Nothing's going to hurt you.
Not yet.
Be quiet, Anna.
No offense, I'm sure, but some people who occupy this room get on my nerves.
I don't want to seem stupid. I know there must be some explanation, but I don't understand this.
Understand what, my dear?
Where am I? And how did I get here? And who are you?
Now, please, miss, whatever else you do, don't start that all over again.
Start what all over again?
Telling us you've lost your memory and don't even know what your name is.
Are you insane? Of course I know what my name is. I'm Helen Barton.
Well, it's a mercy you admit that at last.
At last? But I've never spoken to you before in my life. And where am I? Why on earth is it so cold?
Well, it's pretty hard to be cozy here in the middle of December.
Did you say December?
That's right, that's right. The 18th of December.
Oh, you're fooling me. You're playing a trick on me. My head feels queer and I want to cry. I won't. Could we have some lights?
Of course, straight away.
It can't be December, I tell you. That's impossible. It was only yesterday and all the flowers were out. I was going up to see Philip. That's it. I was going up to see Philip.
Philip? Who?
Philip Gale, the man I was going to marry. It's coming back to me now. It was yesterday, and I started up to see Philip.
Oh, for heaven's sake, miss.
Be quiet, Hannah. And don't on her those lights yet.
Oh, she's having us on,
Hannah. This girl's shaking all over, and she doesn't know where she is. Now, listen to me. I'm going to sit down on the bed beside you. Now, just take my hands and hold them tight. What's wrong? Why are you looking at me like that?
I've got something to tell you.
Is it about Philip?
It is about him. Yes, in a way. I want you to keep tight hold of my hands.
You see, Miss Barton, this is Maidhurst Prison.
Steady now, steady.
I'm still dreaming. I must be. It was the end of August, and I started up to see Philip. You can't mean I'm in prison.
Now listen, my dear. I'm afraid it's worse than that.
Worse than that?
Look over there. You see where there's a little bit of fire in the grate?
Well,
and paper on the wall, and pictures, and a carpet on the floor.
Why can't you come out straight and tell her?
They're going to hang you in the morning, Miss Barton. This is the condemned cell.
No!
There were few Dr. Fell stories broadcast after the demise of Appointment with Fear in 1955. One featured radio's favourite Dr. Watson, Norman Shelley, as Fell, in a dramatisation of The Hollow Man, broadcast in 1959. But in 1997, Enid Williams, the doyen of BBC Radio Detective Story producers, revived Fell for a series of plays that continues to the present. The stories were dramatised by Peter Ling. What were the challenges presented to the dramatiser by the Carr novels?
One of the problems, inevitably, is that there have to be a lot of red herrings in those detective stories so that the reader is going to be not confused, deliberately confused, but the reader is going to at least have moments when they think, is it him, is it her, is it somebody else? You have to have different possibilities. And when you're adapting, you have inevitably to shorten a long, complex novel and to make it into a single story. And so in doing so, you have to abandon some of the subplots. And the danger then is that you're going to be left with too few red herrings. So it is quite it's a sort of balancing act in a way. You have to juggle how much you can drop and how much you need in order to keep the mysteries going.
What is the nature of Peter Ling's working relationship with his producer?
Working with her is an absolute joy. When I send a script in to her and she's read it, she says, well, come up and we'll talk about it. And I then spend an afternoon with her and we go through the script. And normally speaking, most writers would say the most unpleasant thing is going through with a producer who says, don't like this, want to change that, With Enid, it's always a joy because it's a creative process. She says, this could be better, and then we talk together and we find better ways of doing it. And I always come out at the end of the session walking on air. It's lovely.
Enid Williams has produced radio versions of Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. What problems did she face in bringing Gideon Fell to radio?
Poirot, Marple, Holmes, Watson and everybody else are their own individual characters, and here we have somebody who is quite different from them. His very essence is that of the showman, absolutely adores showing off and being a showman and so on. So what one really needed was a bit of imagination and casting more than anything else.
What qualities did Sir Donald Sindon bring to the part?
I think Sir Donald brings himself to the part in every possible way. He is such fun, because I think that's the other thing about Fell, is that he is great fun. He's a man of enormous wit. He is very decent about giving credit to, for example, Hadley, who is his sort of Dr. Watson, as it were. And I wanted somebody who was, could be, a bit larger than life, and Sir Donald certainly can do that, and he is wonderful.
Where's the knife?
Knife?
Yeah.
The poor devil has a bullet in his chest.
I'm talking about the knife which was used to attack this picture. I assume this is the painting that Grimaud bought from Burnaby.
I guess so. What's it supposed to be?
It was a huge canvas, lying on the floor as if it had been pulled down off the wall. A landscape, but no ordinary landscape. A crooked tree and a ghostly range of mountains in the distance. In the foreground were three graves, three headstones. But now there were half a dozen knife slashes in the canvas, which gave the impression that the graves had begun to heave and crack open, as if they were about to give up their dead.
Sir Donald Sindon had not done much radio before his debut as Dr. Fell. What attracted him to the role?
I was sent the script by Enid Williams, who I'd not met before, and I read it and I thought, what fun. I oddly enough, John Dixon Carr, who wrote it, I knew the name immediately, John Dixon Carr, but I hadn't read previously any of his novels on Dr. Fell. Then I discovered that it was based on Chesterton, and I mean, that's a gorgeous character to have, you know, larger than life character, large in body, flamboyant hats. So I imagine myself wearing such a costume. You see, I mean, rather than wear cloaks, rather than overcoats, raincoats, and a cloak, and carrying a walking stick, which I do myself, just for the fun of it. And in fear, I promise you, fear and trepidation, I embarked upon the first, I think.
How does he assess the contribution of Enid Williams to the series?
What would I have done without Enid? It was just my luck to fall into the hands of the most experienced broadcasting producer that's probably ever lived. Wonderful. And I just put myself into her hands. I did exactly what Enid told me to do. And she told me which was the microphone, you know, and it's better if you face that way, she said. If you turn your back, it's not so good, you know. Things like that, simple little things. And every scene involves some new discovery for me. I didn't know that if you walked away from the center of the room to a door, you didn't just walk away, but you had to back off. I mean, everybody else knows this, but except me. I was the only idiot in the piece. And John Hartley is my colleague in the series, and of course he does an enormous amount of broadcasting, and so he was able to hold my hand and give me a little nod over the top of the microphone, saying, yeah, good, that's it.
And radio is particularly good for detective stories, isn't it?
It is. Because you've only got to hear the feet walking down the street, and you think, what's going to happen? Wonderful. And to begin with, I was quite appalling. Enid turned me off time and again, because she kept hearing my pages being turned. Until I watched some of the others doing it, and you just throw the piece away instead of turning it over. There are so many of those wonderful broadcasting stories of turning over the page, aren't they? What is it? The husband, young husband and wife saying, oh, darling, there's our little house. Turn over. On fire!
Period flavour is an important part of the appeal of the Gideon Fell stories. How does Enid Williams go about achieving this?
I think really it's the studio managers who have as much fun as anything with periods within plays, because they are so brilliant at getting just the right car noise, just the right train noise, that are our audio, you know, versions of what you see on television that cost hundreds of thousands of pounds, and they're doing it with putting on a few discs and so on. And I think that's where the real art of something in period lies. And also, of course, with the actors, it's making sure that they understand, and most of them do, and doesn't certainly have to say it to the older caliber, that there is a means in which you finish your words, and that you do say yes and not yeah, which is very easy to say, but you actually do speak in a slightly different way that's not necessarily formalised at all, but it is just a different way of speaking to have a clarity about it, which is not quite the same once you reach a later period. But the 30s, very, very much that's true.
So, carefully evoked 1930s England and Sir Donald Sinden provides an unbeatable combination. Car expert Douglas Green admires Sir Donald's performance.
I like him very much. I think he catches the Johnsonian qualities. John Dixon Carr thought that Dr. Fell ought to have a kind of Samuel Johnson formality, and yet a warmth and friendliness at the same time. And I think Sinden catches that. I liked his performance very much indeed.
That fairy tale England that so inspired John Dixon Carr vanished forever after the Second World War.
He loved England as it was before the war. After the war, when they had rationing, very modern time period, he hated Sir Stafford Cripps. He thought he represented all that was gone wrong. He retreated into historical fiction. And I think Carr ultimately would have liked to have gone back into the past. He did not really like the modern world. And when England became, in his sense, modern, he finally moved back to America and eventually died in South Carolina.
But Carr left a permanent monument to his undying love of that mythic England in the Johnsonian figure of Dr. Gideon Fell, who lives again on the airwaves in the redoubtable person of Sir Donald Sinden.
In part two of The Hollow Man by John Dixon Carr, Dr. Gideon Fell was played by Donald Sinden and Detective Inspector Hadley by John Hartley. The Hollow Man was dramatized for radio by Peter Ling and directed by Enid Williams.